We all want to make the world a better place, but where do we start? This simple question cuts to the core of our polarized culture. It is the most straightforward litmus test for figuring out someone's worldview. Much like Dressgate 2015, it's a matter of perception that seems so fundamental that quite often those with different views struggle to believe that the other person is acting in good faith. When the disagreement is at the level of perception, it feels impossible that another human could see it otherwise, and it almost takes an act of faith to believe they are being genuine. One of the most economical ways of characterizing the divide of the culture wars is as individualists versus collectivists. One side talks about making your bed, and the other talks about systemic racism and sexism. On the Living Philosophy, our tendency has been to focus on the individualist side of this equation. Our perceptual premise is that the best way to improve the world is to start with ourselves. Following Voltaire's Candide, we say that we must cultivate our own garden. Or, as Jordan Peterson would put it, we must make our bed before we try and change the world. We start with ourselves and build an increasingly solid foundation from which to make a bigger and bigger impact on the world. But there is a collectivist point that stands against this individualist one. On this view, the individualist is one of the poor souls in Plato's cave, trying to find salvation in a shadow show cast on the walls by the puppeteers above us. In this episode, we're going to dive into a case study in which we can see the individualist worldview as insufficient, and where it seems to be better to put the collective work ahead of making our own bed. Homelessness is something we usually think of as a mental health or addiction problem. This is the most visible face of the problem. It's the madman on the subway, the lads drinking cans and shouting at people in the park. It's the carousel of tragedy you see on the YouTube channel Soft White Underbelly. But if we look at homelessness in the United States at a collective level, then a different picture begins to emerge. With the working hypothesis of mental health or addiction, we might expect that where these problems are higher, rates of homelessness would be higher. But if we look at the map, that's not what's going on. As Jerusalem Demzas puts it in her article for The Atlantic, if mental health issues or drug abuse were the major drivers of homelessness, then places with higher rates of these problems would see higher rates of homelessness. They don't. Utah, Alabama, Colorado, Kentucky, West Virginia, Vermont, Delaware, and Wisconsin have some of the highest rates of mental illness in the country, but relatively modest homelessness levels. What prevents at-risk people in these states from falling into homelessness at high rates is simple. They have more affordable housing options. The same goes for poverty. You might think of homelessness as a poverty problem, but in Detroit, one of the poorest cities in the US with a very high rate of poverty, homelessness is far lower than New York or LA. As Greg Colburn and Clayton Page put it in their book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem. Homelessness is abundant only in areas with robust labor markets and low rates of unemployment, booming coastal cities. Homelessness is a problem of supply. It is highest in cities where real estate prices are highest. Elliot Sklar, a professor of urban planning at Columbia University, has come up with a helpful analogy for understanding this situation: musical chairs. The first people to lose in musical chairs will be those hampered by some handicap like a sprained ankle. These initial losers are easy to predict. They are the visible face of homelessness, the soft white underbelly we pointed to earlier. But to explain why homelessness is higher in the richest cities in America, you just have to let the game of musical chairs play a couple of rounds more. Once the most vulnerable candidates have already succumbed and the real estate prices continue to climb as demand far outstrips supply, it becomes more difficult to predict who is going to be left without a chair. Instead of character vulnerability, it becomes a question of circumstances. The ripples in the global economy might leave you without a job, and fast forward a couple of months, things begin to get hairy. If we look at the 2023 writer's strike, this was the explicit strategy of the studios. Their plan was to draw out the negotiations long enough that your average writer would struggle to pay their rent and would give in to the studio's demands. At this stage, it becomes a game of circumstance and where and how the chairs are placed. Fewer and fewer chairs, more and more people without chairs. Not enough houses, fewer people with houses. It's a simple equation. For every 10 that pull themselves up by their bootstraps, 2 find the chair kicked from under them by circumstances beyond their control. So, we might ask, why is there a supply problem? According to classical economics, the invisible hand of the market should take care of all this, meeting demand with supply. But it's not so simple. The invisible hand runs into its perennial nemesis, regulation. I want you to imagine a scenario. You live in one of these wealthy cities and you fought tooth and claw for years to get together enough savings so you can just about afford a mortgage on a house. It's extortionate, but at least you can rest assured that the value will increase. And then there's a proposal to build some affordable housing down the road. There's a few reasons why this is not going to sit so well with you. For one, you might reflect on the value of your house. The market is going to lower the price due to the proximity to this cheaper housing. You might imagine some of those crazy homeless people moving in, which won't merely affect the value of your house, but perhaps the quality of your life. Add to this the feeling that you've worked so hard for so long just to get your foot on the property ladder, and these people are just going to be given a house. If you're an idealist, you'll probably try to talk yourself down from these resentful bleedings from your shadow. But the thrust of your instincts is going to throw you against this. Unfortunately enough, there's regulations which allow you to protest this project. Affordable housing is a wonderful idea, you say, but just not here. There's loads of places you could do it, just please not in my backyard. And so, regulation-enabled NIMBY keeps affordable housing out of your neighbourhood and the value of your house is protected. At an individualist scale, this looks alright. They'll just build the houses elsewhere. The trouble is that everywhere in these major cities is expensive and filled with people just like yourself who struggle to afford their houses and can't afford to lose out there. It's a circle of scarcity. It's a short case study, but it has the power to challenge the base contention of our individualist approach to the world. If we move away from the individualist image of homeless people as the mad and addicted and look at the data which points to a deeper problem in the infrastructure, a very different picture emerges, which our self-actualization philosophies are ill-equipped to deal with. The more problems like this in the system, the more equality of opportunity becomes a distant ideal. How can Candide cultivate his own garden when he's living in a motel because the bank foreclosed on his home? How can you make your bed when you find yourself sleeping rough after a downturn in the economy? We might be tempted to see these as edge cases, anomalies in the matrix. And sure enough, they are until you are the winner of this infernal lottery. And as the game progresses and there's less and less survivors in the game of musical chairs, it becomes less and less of an edge case. On an interesting aside, the homelessness problem is a Democrats problem. If we recall the electoral maps of the past 2 presidential elections, we see that the homelessness problem is a problem of major cities, and major cities are exclusively the domain of Democrat voters. To what extent is this a chicken and egg situation? If the concerns of city folks, like the homelessness crisis, are so different from the ex-urban and rural folks, then to what extent is the polarization in American society a tale of 2 Americas, each with its own set of problems? That's all for today's episode. Once again, it's a stepping aside from our usual explorations and situating them in a broader context. It's a reminder that we aren't just living through a nihilistic crisis and a meaning crisis, but a meta-crisis. 21st century society is loaded with challenges, and in following our quest for a better life, we have to situate ourselves in this bigger game. This episode is also a bit of groundwork for future episodes on populism, fascism, Marxism, and other political and economic topics that are essential for understanding the bigger game we find ourselves playing, even if we are unaware of it. For now though, that's everything for this episode of The Living Philosophy. I'd like to thank David Balabosian, Ibiso Feyesa, and all the other patrons for their support of the channel. If you'd like to get access to weekly bonus episodes, monthly Q&As, and get your name in the credits like these fine people, then you can head over to Patreon. As ever, if you have any thoughts, insights, or feedback, I'd love to hear from you down in the comments. Otherwise, I shall see you next time. Thank you for watching.